Women writing about women.
You know, often the job of fiction is to tell the other stories, the human stories, that while people in Zimbabwe are struggling with Mugabe's terrible policies, they are also falling in love, and that both stories are important.
That's Nigerian writer Chimamanda Adichie talking about her stunning collection of stories, The Thing Around Your Neck.
It is about this community of women who climbed this mountain together, but also they become a kind of emblem of the women's movement.
And that's poet Honor Moore talking about Adrian Rich's poem, Fantasia for Elvira Shatayev. It's in the book Moore edited, Poems from the Women's Movement. We'll talk with Moore and hear her read from the book in the second half of the show. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Award-winning author Chimamanda Adichie was born in Nigeria and lives in the United States. She's written about the hardships and political turbulence of her native country in her novels Half of a Yellow Sun and Purple Hibiscus. She's also written about the dislocations and difficulties of Nigerian immigrants to England and the U.S. Her new short story collection, The Thing Around Your Neck, traverses both these territories. The stories are powerful, both in their unflinching look at some of the darkest recesses of the human heart, as well as the capacity for redemption. The Seattle Times said about the book that Adichie shows a rare talent for finding the images and gestures that etch a narrative moment unforgettably in the reader's memory. Chimamanda Adichie, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Your latest book, which is a book of short stories, The Thing Around Your Neck, the title in many ways does convey the feeling of this book. There's a really deep sense of tragedy and sorrow that underlies it. These are very hard stories.
Hmm. I think that they are. I think that I, in general, as a reader and as a writer, I am attracted to a certain kind of melancholy. And also I think that sad, in general, is more interesting than happy. But I also think that the stories have, I mean, my hope is that there is a certain level of sort of a humanity and a slender hope in all of them.
And there is. I mean, I was profoundly moved by your book. Each story, I kept on thinking, there's got to be one in here that isn't as moving as they all seem to be. But they are. They're all very different stories. Many are on the theme of coming to America or of the dislocations of cultures, of the clash of cultures, not just people who emigrate to America or go back to Nigeria, but also the clash between the colonial culture and that of Nigeria. You were born in Nigeria. You left at the age of 19 to live in the United States. There's a character in one of the stories on Monday of last week who is really astonished at the travails of the white Americans that she finds herself among, how they don't know how hard life really can be. She says their sated bellies gave them time to worry. You say sad is more interesting than happy, but in some way, it's a different kind of sadness than what someone with a sated belly might have.
Yes, that is true. And of course, I don't discount that people with sated bellies also have sadnesses. But I think that in the case of that character who had come to the U.S. and was living with sort of upper-middle-class people in suburban Philadelphia, that it was a world that she wasn't very familiar with, and that it surprised her and it amused her, but also that it taught her, you know, that she learned from being there. And I did some babysitting when I first came to the U.S. and I was a student. I did some babysitting for a really lovely family, so nothing at all like the family in the story. But I remember thinking that if I hadn't done that, and it was also for sort of an upper-middle-class Jewish family, that I wouldn't have learned a lot of the nuances of American life or a lot of the nuances of a certain class of Americans.
Tell us a little bit about the story, actually. Actually, what happens in it?
So it's a the Nigerian woman. In many ways, also it's about the strangeness of what distance can do to a marriage. So she married her Nigerian boyfriend. He left Nigeria and came to the U.S. in search of opportunity, as most immigrants do. And because he couldn't get his legal immigration papers for a while, they were separated. She couldn't join him. And so she finally joins him after 6 years and discovers that they have become really different people, that she's become different, and that she no longer feels the same way as she did for him. And it's very disorienting to her, I think. And so when she starts babysitting for this American family, becomes her way of, and she immediately develops a huge crush on the mother of the child she's babysitting. And it's also odd to her because she's never been sexually attracted to a woman in the past. And so suddenly I think that she sort of places on this woman all of the frustrations of her new world. And this crush grows and grows, and she's obsessed with this woman. But the woman herself is quite an enigma. And so the story sort of ends without any clear resolution, I think. But the sense that I hope comes across to the reader is that this Nigerian character has grown, and that because of her experience of babysitting, that, you know, she'll be fine. She'll be okay.
And the woman that she has a crush on, the mother of this boy who Kamara, is that her?
Yes.
Kamara is babysitting for, she's African-American, she's an artist, and she spends all her time in the basement with her art. Talk about what a contrast that must be for Kamara.
I mean, in some ways, Kamara has come from a world in which women, I think that what surprised her wasn't so much that this woman did her own thing, right? Because, you know, Nigeria is full of women doing things and acting. But Kamara was very surprised by how hands-off this woman seemed to be about the about caring for her child, how she just didn't seem, in Kamara's opinion, to be active in the child's life. And so she just sort of closeted herself away in the basement and just didn't seemed to pay attention to the child. On the other hand, it was her husband who actually did a bit of over-parenting in that kind of anxiety-filled way that I think is common in middle-class America.
And there's very much a sense of privilege here, the privilege to over-parent, the privilege to secrete yourself away from your child.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the story is also about discovering different kinds, I think, of privilege.
Right, and I also think of another story in the book. This one takes place in Nigeria, where the privilege is one of class, not of country, a private experience. Set us up. I'd like to ask you to read actually a paragraph, a few paragraphs from the book. Tell us the setting, what's going on here, and then I'm going to have you read starting on page 53, going up to, around to 54.
The story started, actually the background to the story is that in Nigeria from time to time we have these riots that happen, particularly in northern Nigeria. Northern Nigeria is mostly Muslim, but you also have a number of Christians living there. And the Muslim population is mostly Hausa-speaking, so that there's also, in addition to a religious divide, there's an ethnic divide. So it's that Hausa speakers are mostly Muslim. The people who are mostly Christian are from the south and are not native Hausa speakers. And so you sometimes have these riots that erupt, and is often about, you know, it's often triggered by something quite minor, and often it's politicized. Something happens in the marketplace, for example, and then later you hear a story about somebody running for a small political office who had sort of encouraged young Muslim men who don't have jobs to attack Christians. And then often sometimes you also have Christians doing a counterattack. So these things happen, you know, once in a while. And I had read about one of them some years ago, and then an aunt of mine who lives in the north had told me a story about two women, one a non-Muslim and the other one a Muslim, who went into hiding together during one of the riots. She had heard the story somewhere. She didn't have any details. But then I that became the kernel that gave birth to the story. So the story really is about the two women who are hiding away inside a little store, and it's about the unlikely connection that happens between them, particularly because without the riot, I don't think they would ever have had that kind of connection, because one of them is, you know, she's sort of an upper-middle-class Nigerian who's educated, who comes from a family of relative privilege, who's in medical school, who spends her summers outside Nigeria. And the other one is a poor woman from a rural area who sells vegetables in the market.
So now, Chimamanda Adichie, please read for us this passage from your story, A Private Experience, which is part of the collection of stories, The Thing Around Your Neck.
The streets are silent. The sun is falling. And in the evening dimness, Chika looks around, unsure which way to go. She prays that a taxi will appear by magic, by luck, by God's hand. Then she prays that Nnedi will be inside the taxi, asking her where the hell she has been, that they have been so worried about her. Chika has not reached the end of the second street toward the market when she sees the body. She almost doesn't see it, walks so close to it that she feels its heat. The body must have been very recently burned. The smell is sickening of roasted flesh, unlike that of any she has ever smelled. Later, when Chika and her aunt go searching throughout Kano, the policeman in the front seat of her aunt's air-conditioned car, she will see other bodies, many burned, lying lengthwise along the sides of the street, as though someone carefully pushed them there, straightening them. She will look at only one of the corpses, naked, stiff, face down, and it will strike her that she cannot tell if the partially burned man is Igbo or Hausa, Christian or Muslim, from looking at that charred flesh. She will listen to BBC radio and hear the accounts of the deaths and the riots, religious with undertones of ethnic tension, the voice will say. And she will fling the radio to the wall, and a fierce red rage will run through her at how it has all been packaged and sanitized and made to fit into so few words, all those bodies. But now, the heat from the burned body is so close to her, so present and warm, that she turns and dashes back towards the store. She feels a sharp pain along her lower leg as she runs. She gets to the store and raps on the window, and she keeps rapping until the woman opens it.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Nigerian author Chimamanda Adichie about her book of collected stories, The Thing Around Your Neck. Yeah, it's a very powerful description there. And what struck me, too, was a sentence, she'll fling the radio to the wall, and the rage will run through her at how it has all been packaged and sanitized and made to fit into so few words. Could you talk a little bit more about that, about how the terrible reality that is faced by people in this kind of violence, and really in all kinds of violence, the kind of the reality of the world, and how we are so separated from it by words, how it gets mediated?
Well, I just feel, I mean, I haven't personally experienced violence of that sort, but just being aware, you know, being Nigerian and knowing how close it is, in many ways, I wrote my second novel about the Nigeria-Biafra war and her family members who experienced different kinds of violence, and talking to them was very moving for me when I was researching the novel. And I think in some ways that my sense is that sometimes when one reads particularly non-fiction accounts of violence, there's something distancing about them. It's as though by putting the violence into words, a certain kinds of words, you lose the power of thoughts. And I also think that on the other hand, that it can be overdone, you know, that the writing of violence can become pornography and can achieve nothing except for just to horrify, right? But I think that there are ways in which one can do it and in which ways one can write about it or report it that can retain a certain kind of, that in the end just reminds us of the humanity of the people involved.
What is the process that hones the words right down to that kind of heart that reminds us of the humanity?
Oh, I don't know. It's a continuous struggle for me. Writing about violence, which I seem to do quite often, but it's something that I don't know the answer. It's a constant struggle for me.
Before I made the comparison to the Fight Club, which I think is a kind of pornography of violence, and this is really something quite else. It's the way, I think, in which tragedy opens us up to what's important in the human condition. I mean, in this story, A Private Experience, it's not just about the violence, it's about the connection that's made.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, for me, it wasn't actually about the violence at all. I mean, I was horrified by the violence, but it was really about these are the things that can happen. These are the things that human beings can, that in addition to killing one another, human beings can also find ways to connect across all kinds of divides.
And then there's this really wonderful story, a very funny story. I had to think it must have come out of an experience that you had. It's a story of a writer's workshop, another kind of disconnection, the official stories suppressing the real stories, and it's called Jumping Monkey Hill. Tell us about it, and did it come out of an experience you had?
It did. It's actually the only story in the collection that is quite autobiographical. It's, you know, that's consciously autobiographical. So I had attended a workshop in South Africa that was organized by an English man, and it was an African writers workshop. So it was a workshop of writers from different parts of sub-Saharan Africa. And what struck me about being there was that all of us were sort of young and impressionable and very keen to be published, and he was in a position to make that possible. But he also had very firm ideas about what one should write about as an African writer. And so you had to write about the violence of the terrible governments and you know, AIDS and poverty and that kind of thing. And certain stories were considered not authentically African. So you, for example, really couldn't write about homosexual relationships because that really wasn't African, or about people falling in love, or about stories that were quiet and weren't necessarily about, you know, large things like AIDS or poverty. And I remember just feeling that, and not to discount how important these other issues are, but that, you know, often the job of fiction is to tell the other stories, the human stories, that while people in Zimbabwe are struggling with Mugabe's terrible policies, they are also falling in love, and that both stories are important.
And also, he didn't want to hear the stories told from a woman's perspective.
I, in fact, had written a story that was based on the experiences of a friend of mine who lived in Lagos, who had been interviewing for jobs, and who was experiencing a kind of casual sexual harassment that horrified me. So she would walk into an interview, and the man who was interviewing her would sometimes just reach out and grab her breast. And so I wrote sort of a story loosely based on that, and then was very amused to be told that it wasn't based on real life and it was just my feminist agenda writing. And of course, in addition to amusing and annoying me, it also made me wonder what would be considered an authentic story of real women.
Right. And ironic, too, considering the kind of political correctness that was demanded in other ways.
Yes, absolutely.
Now, your characters are all, your main characters are all women. I mean, there are male characters in this book, but the women really anchor it. And in many ways, they are women struggling to break the bonds of how women are seen in Nigeria.
Mm. Yeah, but, you know, I think how women are seen everywhere, really. I really think that we simply live in a world that largely benefits men, that we live in a system of, you know, structures that benefit men as a group. And of course, it doesn't mean that there are individual men who are not who, it doesn't mean that every single man is powerful, but that as a group, men benefit, and it's everywhere. But, you know, I happen to know the Nigerian example a bit better. And I am very interested in gender. I'm very interested in, and I'm also really interested in the complexities of it, and the, in the idea, for example, that women often are socialized to encourage this kind of system that actually doesn't benefit them. So you have mothers who will give more attention, who will privilege their sons. You have grandmothers who will privilege the sons. And you have mothers who raise sons to behave exactly in the same way as, you know, the fathers, who will maintain the status quo. So I'm very interested in not just sort of the simple idea of, oh, you know, men benefit and women, but it's also how women contribute to that.
And, you know, that puts me in mind of, you know, in those countries, you know, like Somalia, for example, where it's the women who practice the female genital mutilation on their daughters. I mean, there's that sense that women are locked into this, that if they don't do this, if they don't socialize their daughters will be lost, will be outcast.
Yes, and nobody will want to marry them and all of those things, yes.
Is that beginning to change in Nigeria?
We don't. I mean, in my part of Nigeria, we don't have female circumcision, so I really don't know very much about it.
Yeah, no, I meant more in the general sense. Do you feel that women...
Oh, I do. And I think for me what's more important is when the changes come from within. So there's actually a film, Usman Sembene's film called Mulade, which is about women in a small West African village who decide that, you know, we no longer want to do this and we will stop it. And I think it's happening. I mean, I think in the same way that different cultural practices that clash with people's fundamental rights are changing. I think these are changing. That you know, increasingly, young girls are no longer being forced into these things. But you know, if you're an adult woman and you choose to do it, then that's an entirely different thing.
We're talking with Nigerian author Chimamanda Adichie about her book of stories, The Thing Around Your Neck. She's also the author of Half of Yellow Sun and Purple Hibiscus. You know, I also think that in some ways there are also traditional values that empowered women. You have another wonderful story of the mother a mother who gives up her son to the Catholic Church. This story is called The Headstrong Historian, which embodies so much of this kind of ambivalence or ambiguity. I mean, she gives up her son to the Catholic Church for a particular reason, which I'll ask you to explain. But she does it really to empower her and her family, where she's become disenfranchised because she has become a widow. Tell us about that story.
The story was actually based on a number of things, but mostly stories about my great-grandmother. I wanted to do something a bit historical. In some ways, I wanted to sort of do a feminist retelling of the history of my people and to do it, you know, through one person. She decides that her son, this is, you know, Eastern Nigeria in the 1890s, and she decides to send her son to school because she realizes that the British had come to stay, and that the old ways would have to sort of pass away, and that the Western education brought by the British, brought by the missionaries, would be the way to succeed. And so she made this sort of pragmatic choice. And she knew that if he then went to school and became powerful, he would be able to speak for her. But then, of course, what happens is that he does go to school, and in some ways he becomes, he changes and becomes a bit of a Christian fundamentalist and turns his back on her because she refuses to convert to Christianity.
And he also, I mean, his wife is very subservient.
His wife is. And for me, it's also quite telling because I really do think that, and I use my great-grandmother and my grandmother as examples. My great-grandmother in pre-Christian Eastern Nigeria had many more rights than my grandmother in Christian Nigeria, who, because I think that what Christianity did was that it brought all of these Victorian values and these ideas of gender that simply had not existed in Igbo land. And obviously I'm not saying that before Christianity, you know, that there was gender parity or anything. There wasn't. It was still a patriarchy, but I think it was one that women had so many more rules and women had more choices. And in some ways it was, if there's such a thing, it was a more tolerable form of patriarchy. And then Christianity came with its Victorian values and its odd ideas about gender and sexuality. And I think it just made the status of women much worse. So suddenly, ideas of property, women couldn't own property, and they could before. Ideas of what kinds of jobs women could have. I mean, in pre-Christian Igbo land, for example, there was such a thing as a women's council, which was really a group of women who had judicial functions. So if a man beat his wife, they would descend on him, they would destroy his hut, they would beat him, they would kill his goats. I mean, they really, and they had the power to do this. And then the British came and set up their courts. And of course, the British had come from a world in which women didn't have those kinds of powers. And so they appointed only men. And so all of a sudden, you had women who had been deprived of these functions and most of all weren't giving alternatives. So I think in the story, for example, the great-grandmother clearly, it had never occurred to her to be as subservient as her son's wife.
And yet, the granddaughter is really a redemptive figure there.
What she's doing is what I like to call the reclaiming of history. The granddaughter, who then becomes Western educated and starts asking questions, and eventually she starts retelling their stories. She starts making an effort to reclaim their history.
Now, I want to ask you about, I think it was probably the most, and I say this without wanting to drive listeners away, because it is really an incredible story, but the most disturbing story for me was a story, Tomorrow Is Too Far, about a girl who does not like her brother. Her brother is in a privileged position, a position she rebels.
Yes.
And I'm not sure how much I can say without giving the story away, so I'll leave that up to you. That affected me very, very strongly, and I'm not exactly sure why, other than the fact that it's a shocking story in itself.
Mm. Yes, a friend of mine who reads all of my work read that and said, you're going very dark, I'm worried. And I wanted to write about childhood and how childhood often isn't the kind of idealized innocence that we, when I say we, I mean adults, make it out to be. And about what children are, you know, sort of Lord of the Flies kind of thing, what children are capable of can sometimes be, unpleasant.
Enormously cruel.
Yes, I think children are very capable of cruelty, and that we don't always acknowledge that.
And, you know, maybe even like with Lord of the Flies, I mean, even more extreme in the sense that they may not fully really understand what the consequences. I mean, as an adult,
yes.
She has to live with what she's done.
Yes. I think that's really the key, that in addition to that, children are capable of these things, but don't necessarily have they haven't been equipped in many ways with the kind of system of checks and balances that most adults have. And so that only when they become adults do they start to, as she did, she starts looking back. And she's full of remorse. But, you know, the things you just can't take back.
You know, in the beginning of our interview, you said that sad is more interesting than happy. Mm-hmm. And I'd like you to explain that in how that informs your writing. In other words, what is interesting about sad for you when you sit down to write a story?
I think maybe it's just that fiction, in the most basic sense, requires conflict, and it's just harder to do conflict when all is well. But I think it's also, I mean, I really don't know what it is. I just find that I, as a writer and as a reader, I am drawn to sadness, but the kind of sadness that gives room for a redemptive hope. So I don't much care for absolute despair.
And who do you read? Who are your inspirations?
I like to say that the Nigerian writer Chinua Achebe is the writer whose work is most important to me, because in many ways he gives me permission to write. His work gave me permission to tell my own stories, because until I read him, I didn't quite know that I could write about people like me, people who lived in my world. And reading him opened my eyes. And so he, and his work, by the way, has that kind of beautiful sadness that moves me. And so he's in many ways he's the most important writer for me.
Well, I think you are... you are a very worthy inheritor of his work. Your stories are beautiful. Your latest book is The Thing Around Your Neck. Chimamanda Adichie, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Francesca.
Adichie's novel, Half of a Yellow Sun, won the Orange Broadband Prize and was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. She's the recipient of a 2008 MacArthur Foundation Fellowship. Next up, we talk with poet Honor Moore about poems from the women's movement. Stay tuned.
The woman in your life will do what she must do to comfort you and calm you down and let you rest now. The woman in your life, she can rest so easily. She knows everything you do, because the woman in your life is in.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In her poem about the climber Elvira Shatayev, Adrienne Rich uses the image of a cable of blue fire as a metaphor for the solidarity of women facing the challenges of their lives. Before the women's movement was born in the 1970s, the idea of women's solidarity was foreign to our culture. Women were supposed to compete for a man, not join together to explore and enrich their own lives. Poet and writer Honor Moore was there at the beginning of the women's movement. She points out in her wonderful introduction to the new collection, Poems from the Women's Movement, in which Rich's poem appears, that poetry was vital to it, giving eloquent voice to lives that had been until then largely unspoken. Poetry empowered the women's movement as it empowered the poets of it. Honor Moore has authored three collections of her own poetry, Red Shoes, Darling, and Memoir. She's also written plays and a celebrated memoir, The Bishop's Daughter. Along with other poets and readers, Moore will be talking about poems from the women's movement at a reading at Amherst College on September 16th. Well, Honor Moore, welcome to Writer's Voice.
My pleasure to be here.
This is a wonderful collection of poems, Poems from the Women's Movement.
Mm-hmm.
I was struck by, first of all, you write a really lovely introduction to this collection. It's just fascinating and brought back many memories for myself. I joined the women's movement in 1970,
mm-hmm.
and that was a momentous event in my life, my first consciousness-raising meeting that I went to.
Mm-hmm.
It was life-changing.
Yes.
And you quote somebody in your book who says that the women's movement was poetry. What did they mean by that?
Well, it was a time when, for instance, I, too, was in a consciousness-raising group, but I would say the most powerful life-changing experience for me was when I was invited to read my poems in a group poetry reading at NYU, and maybe 30 of us read. Many of those people did not end up being poets, but women were, in any way possible, either through consciousness-raising groups, through violently polemical essays, and through poems, seeking to have access to a part of themselves which had been suppressed in the 1950s, 1960s, post-war American society. So that a friend was reminding me yesterday, it was a time when a New York Times want ad would say, "Help wanted, men only."
Wow.
So that if you wanted to be something other than a secretary or a nurse's aide or a nurse, you couldn't. apply for the job. And as I was saying to a younger interviewer the other day, think about it. No women's centers, no battered women's shelters. It was a time when you could read every book that a woman had written. So you started to have a little shelf on which there were books by women. No women doctors, no women lawyers, no women Supreme Court justices, and on it goes. I think that maybe even we forget that, women of our generation, but certainly young women who, although there's still work to be done, young women, you know, they can go to medical school. There's no quota on how many women a medical school accepts. You know, there were many more all-male colleges, many more all-female colleges. There was a definite tracking system into gender roles, and that experience was deeply internalized. And so it made sense that an art form like poetry, which speaks, as it were, from the soul, would begin speaking as a woman. It's interesting, in the anthology, I open it with Sylvia Plath's poem, The Applicant.
And would you actually read that for us here?
You want me to read the whole poem?
Well, maybe not the whole poem, but
I'll read the first few stanzas. Okay, I'll read the first few lines. The Applicant, Sylvia Plath. First, are you our sort of person? Do you wear a glass eye, false teeth, or a crutch, a brace, or a hook, rubber breasts, or a rubber crotch? In the introduction, you know, I talk about the fact that we all wore girdles, which were made of rubber, at least partially of rubber. So for her to say rubber crotch is not merely, you know, it is metaphorical, but it's also based in reality. And this is part of what began to happen for women poets. We began to speak from our own lives. For instance, there's Susan Griffin's poem, An Answer to a Man's Question, What Can I Do About Women's Liberation? The beginning of the poem, wear a dress. Wear a dress that you made yourself or bought in a dress store. Wear a dress and underneath the dress, wear elastic around your hips and underneath your nipples. Wear a dress and underneath the dress, wear a sanitary napkin. Wear a dress and wear slingback high-heeled shoes. Wear a dress with elastic and a sanitary napkin underneath and slingback shoes on your feet and walk down Telegraph Avenue.
You mentioned that your great life-changing event was a poetry reading at NYU. Could you describe the scene for us? You talk about that in the book. Put us there.
Well, it's a room in the lately lamented Loeb Student Center, now torn down and replaced by something huger. You know, a kind of one of those college, university gathering rooms, sort of linoleum tile on the floor, fluorescent light. And the entire room was packed with women. They were all wearing blue jeans and combat boots and sandals and dressed like we were in our rebellious way. Of course, some had heavy eye makeup and black turtlenecks. You know, it was a kind of spectrum of dress. And there weren't enough chairs for everybody. I remember sitting on the floor, and one after another, a woman would get up to the front, and she would say, you know, my name is so-and-so, and I'm going to read this poem. And she would read a poem about having been a prostitute, or a poem about having had an abortion, or a poem about her husband having left her flat, or she might be Rita Mae Brown, in which case she'd read this poem, which I just adore. My voice rings down through thousands of years to coil around your body and give you strength. You who have wept in direct sunlight, who have hungered in invisible chains, tremble to the cadence of my legacy. An army of lovers shall not fail. Okay, she would read that, and everybody would hoop and scream and holler and carry on. I mean, these were revolutionary words at the time. And each poem would sort of demonstrate a revelation. And these readings would take place all over the country. For instance, there was a whole movement of women poets happening at the same time in California. And one of the leaders of that movement was a poet named Alta. She ran a press called Shameless Hussy Press. And here's her short poem, Miscarriage. Let's try again. Lots more where that came from. Ha ha. Don't say lost the baby. Sounds like you misplaced it. Let's see. I had it here a couple of days ago. And these poems were shocking. You know, the way of looking at the world was shocking at the time. And so one left such events feeling that you were not alone. And then we started having these group readings all the time. So you'd have to write another poem so that you'd have another poem to read at the next reading. And that's how we began to write Poems Women, as I say. And one of the poems that I wrote for one of those events was called Polemic Number One, which starts, "This is the poem to say write poems women because I want to read them, because for too long we have had mostly men's lives or men's imaginations wandering through our lives, because even the women's lives we have details of come through a male approval desire filter, which diffuses imagination, that most free part of ourselves." The poem goes on, and actually I realized while writing it that male approval desire spells M-A-D, mad. So later in the poem I say, "I have driven many women mad." You know, the women's movement is said to have been humorless. Au contraire, we really had a lot of humor with our rage. But of course, there were then darker and more painful poems.
We're talking with poet Honor Moore about poems from the women's movement. She edited the anthology, which is part of the American Poets Project from the Library of America. It spans works from 1965 to 1982, including those of Sylvia Plath, Marge Piercy, Audre Lorde, Adrienne Rich, and many others. You say in your introduction, and you really hear it here, that the inner lives of women came into language.
That's right.
You actually start with Sylvia Plath.
Yes.
Tell us why.
I start with Sylvia Plath because I really mark the beginning of this movement of women poets with the publication in the United States in 1966 of Sylvia Plath's Ariel. At that time, she had been dead 2 or 3 years, so one had heard about this woman poet who had committed suicide, and now these poems were widely available in this book called Ariel, and it was like a shock. The poet Jean Valentine, who has a poem in the book, actually said, reminiscing about those years, that she had a manuscript ready for publication when she read those poems from Ariel, and she just sat down and rewrote it. She felt that she was given permission to be much more overt and much more open with her experience as a woman. And I don't mean merely from the point of view of confession, but I mean making use of elements of female experience as metaphor.
So you're really saying that in giving language to women's interior lives, that this is the voice that had been silenced for centuries, really?
For centuries. Now, in fact, once we began to write our poems, we could look back at poets whom we perhaps had read in college and see that their most powerful and overtly female work had been suppressed. For instance, you would have a poet like H.D. who wrote these sort of marvelous, epic, modernist poems like Trilogy and Helen in Egypt, which to my mind are on a par with Pound's Cantos and Eliot's The Wasteland in terms of their ambition and in terms of the way they conceive of what a poem can do. But the poems of H.D.'s that one read were short little imagistic poems. So there were women writing strong poems, but as the canon began to be formed and women were given their one or two slots, often the poems that were chosen were not the poems to which a woman of my generation starting to write poems could, out of that kind of new feminist rage, could relate. The other thing was that I think that many women poets were stuck in a kind of honesty out of a situation of oppression. That is to say, Plath and Sexton, you know, were writing protest poems out of their condition as women. And what happened in the moment I celebrate and mark in this anthology, it was a kind of explosion that cleared the way for women to write more deeply and ambitiously, to take on more of the world. Also allowed, I think, and given permission for, in this moment, were great bodies of work by Adrienne Rich, Audre Lorde, Muriel Rukeyser, June Jordan.
What you're really talking about here is, you know, what the women's movement really brought. I think the great innovation that the women's movement brought to society, and that is the idea that the personal is political.
Yes, which has become trivialized in subsequent decades, but which at the time, and what that means is that each of us walks around in the world with an individual social identity, social/political identity, and that my identity as a woman is different from, as a white privileged woman, is different from somebody else's identity as an African American working class man, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that our lives carry with them a politics. And that was really something that the women's movement invented.
Yes, it did. And also, you mentioned Adrienne Rich, who I think was my first favorite poet as a teenager and a young woman. And she talks about the tradition of connectedness, which is another whole theme of the women's movement. You know, we had been raised to see other women as rivals.
Yes, as rivals. And competitors, and certainly not the other people in a community of which we might feel lucky to be a part. And that really was her among many great connections, that the third poem of hers that I include, Fantasia for Elvira Shatayev. I remember the first time I heard that poem was when she read it, and Elvira Shatayev was the leader of a women's climbing team, all of whom died in a storm on Lenin Peak in the USSR in August 1974. And the husband finds and buries the bodies. And it's a poem about this community of women. It is about this community of women who climbed this mountain together, but also they become a kind of emblem of the women's movement. As she writes, she's writing in the voice of Elvira Shatayev, "Now I am further ahead than either of us dreamed." She's talking to her husband. "Anyone would be. I have become the white snow packed like asphalt by the wind, the women I love lightly flung against the mountain, that blue sky. Our frozen eyes unribboned through the storm. We could have stitched that blueness together like a quilt." And then she refers to the women as a cable of blue fire. "A cable of blue fire ropes our bodies burning together in the snow. We will not live to settle for less. We have dreamed of this all our lives." And it's a kind of moment when she's writing at the height of her powers, and the metaphor of that, the sense of what we're all part of, comes together in that very strong metaphor. I later taught a class in the history of women poets, and I called it a cable of blue fire. That idea that I was talking about before, that we found our sisterhood in the poets who had gone before, when we began to really scrutinize the work of theirs that had been suppressed or misread.
She has another poem that you have in the book, Honor Moore, and the book is Poems from the Women's Movement, Planetarium. Uh-huh. And I love the way it begins with a woman in the shape of a monster in the shape of a woman. The skies are full of them, you know, referring to the way in which women have been mythologized.
Yes.
In the naming of the constellations.
Right.
And I wonder if you could talk about the role of myth in the women's movement.
Yes, I think that a lot of women poets went back to Greek and Roman mythology to find and reread certain the lives of certain women. One in particular that I'm thinking of in this book is Louise Glück's poem Pomegranate, which is about Persephone, and Alice Notley's wonderful short poem called The Goddess Who Created This Passing World. There were many goddess poems. I was thrilled to find this one. I'll read it because it's short and glorious. The goddess who created this passing world, the goddess who created this passing world said, let there be light bulbs and liquefaction. Life spilled out onto the street, colors whirled, cars and the variously shod feet were born in the past and future, and I born too. Light as air mail paper, away she flew to Annapurna or Mount McKinley or both, but instantly clarified, composed. Forever was I meant by her to recognize a painting as beautiful or a movie stunning, and to adore the finitude of words, and to understand as surfaces my dreams, know the eye, the organ of affection, and depths to be inflections of her voice and wrist and smile. A wonderful poem about the integration of the goddess into our consciousness. And I think what happened was that, you know, women poets just went nuts with all these great women in myth. I end the book with Eileen Miles' wonderful poem about Joan of Arc, in which she sort of takes this forceful Joan, and, you know, usually Joan dies at the end. But in this poem we have, she was 19 years old when they burned her body in the middle of town while she was still alive. A white dove came out of her mouth as she died, 431 years ago today. A dove leaped right out of her mouth. And I love that idea that a dove, which is a kind of image of peace and also transformation, and also poetry, you know, sort of the idea of poetry being something which speaks what cannot be spoken, emerging as a dove. And in a way, I see the book as, you know, it begins with are you sort of person, and it ends with a dove leaped right out of her mouth. And that's quite a distance to go in a little more than a decade.
Yes, and that is a beautiful poem. And you're really talking about the whole way in which women reclaimed and redefined mythology, because of course women in myth had often so for so many centuries been defined by man.
Yeah.
And there's another poem I think that really speaks right to that, to kind of the demystification of women, saying, hey, we're real. And that's Katha Pollitt's poem, Metaphors of Women.
Yeah, she said, what if the moon was never a beautiful woman? Call it a shark shearing across black water, an ear, a drum in the desert, a window, a bone shoe. What if the sea was discovered to have no womb? Let it be clouds, blue as the day they were born, a ceremony of bells and questions, a toothache, a lost twin. What if a woman is not the moon or the sea? Say map of the air, say green parabola, lichen and the stone that feeds it. No rain. Rain.
Tell us your reaction to that poem.
Well, it's just saying enough already with the moon is a woman and the womb is the sea, and, you know, it's enough with sort of the old kinds of metaphors that we connect women to, and it's time to rewrite those myths or just to get rid of them.
And on another point, you also mentioned before the kind of the darker place. You talk about how the women's movement and the poetry within it, you know, had a phrase about speaking bitter.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, telling the truth of the experience that women had been through. There's a poem by Joan Larkin, A Rhyme of My Inheritance, that goes, I think, right to that. And I just wonder if you would read maybe the first two stanzas of that.
Sure. It's on page
126.
Rhyme of My Inheritance. My mother gave me a bitter tongue. My father gave me a turned back. My grandmother showed me her burned hands. My brother showed me a difficult book. These were their gifts. The rest was talk. I discovered my body in the dark. It had a surprise in its little crack. I started to say what I'd found in the dark, but my mother gave me a dirty look, and my father turned a key in the lock. I was left alone with the difficult book and the stove that burned my grandmother's hands, and while they muttered behind my back, I learned to read and to make my bread, to eat my words, and lie flat in my bed. They took me to school where I learned to be cute. I wore clean jumpers and washed my hands. I put my hands up to cover my mouth. I listened to everything everyone said and kept what I could in my stuffed-up head. She says, may I let go of these bitter rhymes and may this burial be my last while I live in my body and learn from my bones to make some less predictable sound. Let this coffin of verses inherit my pain.
That's such a powerful poem.
Yeah, really. Just and the wonderful ballad form of it really strengthens that as well.
Yeah. Honor Moore, while the women's movement certainly had its share of internal conflict, often centering around issues of race and class, you point to the solidarity in the movement that also flourished.
One of the reasons I love the photograph on the cover of this book is that it does really note the diversity of the women's movement as I remember it at the beginning. And I think that it's one of the truths of the women's movement that it was racially diverse from the very beginning.
With poets like Audre Lorde and others as well. I mean, great, great poets.
Yes, but also activists. Not that we didn't work on racism, you know, but it was something that was worked on from the very beginning.
Poet Honor Moore, and the book is Poems from the Women's Movement. It's a collection of poems from 1965 to 1982. And at writersvoice.net, you'll be able to read Honor Moore's poem, Polemic One, as well as Fantasia for Elvira Shatayev by Adrienne Rich. At the break, we heard Holly Neer's The Woman in Your Life Is You. Neer is one of the great singers of the women's movement. We'll go out with more from Holly Neer. Here's Fire in the Rain. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.